Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I don't want to give the impression that I am knocking third parties, as Granville alluded to. I am actually knocking the political system, because at the end of the day, it has to make sense. So I asked the panel this question. What would your success look like? Had you had the branches? Was there no victimization? Had you had the finances, the policy, the personnel, and all the other things that the parties have? Your success essentially means you either become the government or you become the opposition. That is what your success look like, what will look like. Ask yourself this question. In the 80s, when the NDP, not the Barbados Labour Party, as the official opposition in Parliament, what constitutionally did the Parliament of Barbados allow the Barbados Labour Party to do other than debate? So the success of a third party essentially means they're not third parties. They're either the government or the opposition. So it has to make sense. Third parties are a square peg in a round hole under our parliamentary system. So until you address that parliamentary system, you can have all the finances in the world. You can have all the branches. You can have all the personnel. It does not work under our constitutional makeup. And that is what we have to begin discussing. I'm not knocking third parties. My area of expertise is actually broadening democracy. I am all for it. But at the end of the day, the system has to allow for it to work. So my question to you is, what would your success look like? Not becoming either government or opposition as opposed to a third party? That is what it would say.
Are you making a case, therefore, for reform of the political system, constitutional reform? Are you making a case for proportional representation has been advocated from time to time by various persons?
That is exactly what I'm calling for. First, you would need to look at the electoral system and recognize that 50% plus one vote is not very democratic, because you're leaving out a host of other individuals that now have no representation. So a proportional representative system then would make sense, because it's more representative and therefore then more democratic. Beyond the electoral system, you now have to look at the parliament and how the parliament literally speaks to the inclusion of other individuals. Again, look at the situation of the NDP and how they knocked the BLP as the official opposition and what happened. So our parliament now has to speak towards a multiplicity of parties and how they can be included in the cabinet, how they can be included in various aspects of parliamentary governance, whether it's the PAC, whether it's appointments, whatever aspect you want to speak of. I mean, we can look at the Scandinavian countries and see how best they do it, but they can't do it under the current system that we have, which only speaks to a leader of an opposition and a prime minister, and therefore two parties. The system does not allow for it.
Do you expect, given your expertise and your familiarity with the systems around the world, do you expect that the two major political parties, the BIP and the DAP, who have a vested interest in maintaining the system, which ensures that either one of them forms the government, do you expect, how much enthusiasm do you expect, or have you detected among either or both of them for the constitutional reform that would involve the enhancement of other groups, say through proportional representation? Do you expect that to come see the light of day realistically?
And there's a simple answer to that, and the answer is no, because our political culture is one, as Granville pointed to, one of division. And politicians essentially benefit from division, and benefit from a divided political system. And at the end of the day, we call ourselves a mature democracy, but we're anything of the sort, because quite frankly, our system is one where half of your population is essentially cut off because they're not in government. And that is how we practice politics, one at a time, as opposed to literally all hands on deck, as opposed to saying actually doing it so everybody can contribute and lead to our development. But no, we don't do it.
Dennis, if we have any call, we'll take a call here. We'll take the go to the calls. Brass Stacks?
Hello. Hello.
Yeah, go right ahead, please.
Good morning. Good morning. Wonderful program so far. I'm not as knowledgeable as Mr. Bruce on this matter, but I prefer to say that the Constitution is silent on the issue of multi-party systems in Barbados. And having said that, I believe that just because the Constitution does not directly make provisions for third parties, it does not mean a third party cannot emerge or emerge successfully. The Constitution does not stop anybody from forming a political party. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. But certainly, and neither does it stop anybody from trying to make their political party a viable option with the potential to form the government. So perhaps a constitutional lawyer can help me here. Because bottom line, political parties do compete, and the Constitution don't prevent them from competing. It's the first pass, I suppose, undergirded system, undergirded by the Constitution that takes care of the outcome. I want to go back to 1946, though, when I heard Mr. Bruce talking about reforming parliamentary form and how he's not knocking third parties, but he's knocking how the whole system is set up. The general election of November in 1946, the Barbadoes Labour Party, led by Grantley Adams, won 9 seats. The West Indian National Congress Party, led by Winter A. Crawford, 7 seats. The Barbados Electors Association, led by Mr. Jack H. Wilkinson, 6 seats, and 2 independents were elected to Parliament. So I said all of that to say that I do not support this notion that our parliamentary system so needs such reform that in order to accommodate a third party. My second point, quickly, I don't want to take too much time.
Before you move on, Carla, you have to recognize that that was before there was adult suffrage in 1951.
Understood. But it was still the same. We're still talking about the same parliamentary system, you know. That's why Barbados has one of the oldest parliamentary systems anywhere in the world, because it hasn't changed significantly. We were supposed
You mean it hasn't changed structurally?
The dynamics would have changed
because you've not broadened the franchise.
But certain dynamics would have changed. But you're talking about Mr. Bruce is saying, that the whole parliamentary system needs reform, and he's also talking about constitutional reform, if I'm not mistaken. But he could address that after I get off the phone. I want to make this other point very, very, very quickly. Now, for me, the issue boils down to the distribution and redistribution of political power and the openness of the electorate to new political parties in Barbados. I have no problem with people having ideas about the ways in which they could contribute to the political landscape of the country. They may form any political alliance, but I believe the reality in today's context is that new political parties require money more so than any ideological or philosophical position. Because like the other political parties, established political parties, their ideologies and philosophies are going to fit into the familiar democratic socialist template. So to me, it really doesn't matter how good
even though some of them deem themselves as progressives.
But it's going to fit into that democratic socialist template. If you look at it carefully, if you look at the manifesto of the Solutions Barbados, if you look at the UPP, if you look at all of them, they fit into that democratic socialist template. All right, so to wrap up my point, the reality is the success of any new political party in Barbados depends on money, all who the party can attract for membership, and how widely received the party is by the public. So the primary goal, to me, for any political party should be about becoming sustainable and becoming sufficiently recognized and accepted by the public as having the potential to form the government.
Would you say then that, given your proposition, your thesis, that the primary goal should be to raise money to get funds?
Well, they have to do that. That has to be
in the initial stages.
Precisely, that has to be the foundation upon the longevity and the sustainability of any new political party in Barbados. It is the same for the established ones too, because they need money, but they've had a long time to develop, a long time to grow. But let us be realistic. There's things that people may not want to hear, but it is the reality of the situation. The foundational aspects. You need money, first of all, before you have any ideological, fanciful, ideological or philosophical position. You need to
money to build a profile for the party.
Yeah, because the party.
There's a perception from my experience in Barbados that you have to fill the eyes of the public.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, I won't put this to you. I maintain the NDP. Remember what Richie Haynes said, the late Richie Haynes said? He could no longer carry the party. The financial burden was too heavy. That party if it had continued, if the foundational aspects were in place in terms of money, that party had the potential to grow. That party had the potential for longevity. But Sir Richard at the time could not maintain or sustain the economic viability of the party. And that's why the thing fell apart. So I reject this notion that there's no room for the emergence or the successful emergence of a third party because the constitution or the system, parliamentary system, does not facilitate such. You're going to meet some obstacles, but there's nothing saying that you can't overcome it.
In your view, would you say that there's a thirst and a hire and a hunger and desire at the Barbadian public level for a alternative constitution, third party, emergent party? You think that people, there's strong enough desire for people to want that to really make a difference?
Glenn, I can't really answer that from where I sit because I have not spoken to a vast majority of Barbadians, especially young Barbadians, to find out what it is they're really looking for, because that group confuses me in their political thinking, their political ambition. I'm not sure how to address that question. But certainly I will not accept the notion that there's no room for the emergence of a third party in Barbados.
But you spoke about young Barbadians. What about the more mature Barbadians who are more reliable at voting? Do you think that there's any appetite among them for that?
I can't even speak for them either because I'm not sure. But I know, I recognize, we have a dominant two-party system in Barbados. But that is the established norm. That's what we've come to accept over the years. But even some of the older Barbadians have crossed over to accept the UPPs, the PPP, the Solutions Barbados. So it is unless you do research and you do your analysis, you cannot determine whether or not Barbadians are ready to accept the emergence of a third party with the potential to form the government. That is something that would require research. I can't speak off the top of my head about that.
Thank you very much, Carla, for your very interesting and useful contribution. We come back after the news with Brassac Sundays with compliments of Williams Industries, Inc. Welcome back again down to Brass Tacks, compliments of Williams Industries Incorporated, with Dennis Johnson as your technical operator and producer and Glenn Murray as your moderator, along with expert host of guests. We have Devrin Bruce, who is a political scientist from the University of West Indies. Granville Phillips, who is the founder and leader of Solutions Barbados. There's Bishop Joseph Alderley from the United People's Party for Development and Democracy, and Raquel Jilks of United Progressive Party. Gentlemen and lady, before we go, before I come back to you, I will ask your comments on what you've heard since you last were on air. But before I do that, I'd like to make the point that from here on, I'd like to not only deal with the past experience of the political parties, the emerging parties, the third parties, or whatever you might, but I want to deal with the present and more so the future. Because my experience, my studies, and my instinct, my political instinct tell me that we are halfway into a new political term, halfway into a term, and then we have to start looking towards the next election. I get the feeling that the political parties, as our guests here today, would seem to think that they would like to be or want to be or intend to be around for the next election, which constitutionally due in 2023. But I'd like to know how they intend to prepare for themselves based on their past experience and what they see as their current problems and probably future difficulties. I'd say that in the context of one of my mantras in politics and life in general, that I do not believe in coincidences. And there are certain moves that I've observed in the governing party, the Barbados Labour Party, that tells me that they themselves have begun to start to put in place a shape for the next election, a plan for the next election. I tell you what, and I think, for example, the increased involvement of now Ambassador Liz Thompson in the political process. You will recall that she had come back from abroad, and I understand towards the end of last year, when we went, and I understand she had played a big role in the preparation and writing of the throne speech. That is what my information from within the BLP tells me, and if I'm wrong, I'll have to lay on my sources. But I also see that It's not that the government recognizes that it has a hands full of a lot of issues, COVID, the economy, and it's keeping them so busy that the present group of ministers, et cetera, don't have the time to devote exclusively to prepare for the next election. I suspect that part of Ambassador Thompson's role would be to work behind the scenes or whatever, and it was a start to position the party for the next election, because they have, the Prime Minister has the authority and the right to call and name when she would want to have a general election. So I'd like to also ask your reaction to my proposition, and also comment on what transpired over the last time before we took the last break. And Bruce, would you like to go? Hello?
Hey. All right, so I would really leave the future of the third parties, alternative parties, emerging parties to persons who are in them. But what I would emphasize and remit based on the previous call is that the previous caller mentioned 1946, where there were a multiplicity of political parties within parliament. No, certainly there's nothing constitutionally that prevents you from doing that. But I think what the caller needs to recognize is that parliamentary politics, by and large, is about the ability to make decisions. So the question becomes, where does decision making happen within our parliamentary system? The cabinet, which is essentially one party, and the upper and lower house, which tend to be two parties within our political context. So the question becomes, when you have a third party, are they going to be consulted when it comes to judicial appointments? Are they going to have any powers as it relates to the members of the Electoral and Boundaries Commission? Are they going to be sitting on the PSC? Are they going to chair the PSC? What roles do they have outside of Barbados? So the question becomes, again, what constitutional powers are admitted to you as a third party? The Constitution does not provide for that to happen. And I think that is fundamentally what has to be addressed from government, from the opposition, from the political parties, and everybody else. We need to recognize that is what fundamentally needs to be done.
Bishop, I think you're very well placed to respond to that. Yeah.
I want to say I agree with Bruce on this last comment. I also agree with him on his previous last comment. And I agree with your last caller. I think there's serious need for revolutionary reforms. I said that earlier with respect to governance and our political and parliamentary structures, constitutional structures. Listen, the PDP sees this as very important. That's one of the aspects of newness that we're wanting and attempting to advocate. Let me give you an example. We have a Senate, as I earlier said, it is comprises 12 appointees of the Prime Minister, two of the opposition leaders, seven of Her Excellency, the Governor General. Here's a role for a third. Here is an opportunity for a third party in the context of some constitutional parliamentary reform. The allocation of a number of seats in the Senate for emerging parties that achieve a qualifying threshold in terms of the voter support that party or those parties are able to attract. So a third party, you call it emerging party, participates in an election. As Bruce rightly said, right now the two-party system, government or an opposition. You get a seat in parliament, you have one or two seats in parliament. What role do you play? I'm simply saying, based on a set threshold of voter support, you can ascribe to an emerging party a number of seats in the Senate as it now is constituted. You can also ensure that there's a change in the role of the Senate with respect to how it functions. Senate must be made more muscular in terms of its effort to scrutinize government policy and to scrutinize functionaries of government on the front lines who are responsible largely for the spending of government money. The Senate in the Barbados context should be given a role similar to that which obtains in the United States.
Well, there's some people, with all due respect, Bishop, there's some people who say that to get that muscularity, some of the membership of the Senate should be elected directly by the public.
That's the point I'm making. You should have elected positions. You should have elected positions to the Senate of Barbados. And I'm saying you can have a threshold established in terms of the voter support garnered that would allow third parties to impact that process and have some of their membership in there as well. I'm saying, broadly speaking, we don't have the time today, but we can talk about this, Marie, one-on-one if you want. And we have to revamp the role of the Senate and how it is made up. I support Bruce on the whole issue of proportional representation. I know there are risks involved with that. The experience elsewhere suggests that there's some instability, but at least it broadens the democratic expression. It gives greater legitimacy, in my view, to the democratic exercise that we go through every 5 years in voting for somebody. I and others with me can vote for a third party candidate, get a certain number of votes, but never see a seat in parliament. That is not the intention of our constitution, I do not think. And if it is, then we have to change it to allow that we do practice this democracy in fuller and more meaningful measure, such that when you, Marie, go to vote, or Sir Dennis Johnson goes to vote, your vote counts. Right now, this two-party system and this two-party culture, people believe that if I vote for the emerging party or third party, my vote will be wasted. And on that score, Marie, I don't want to get as scathing as Mr. Phillips did earlier in terms of reference to the media, but there's always a bias on the part of the media with reference to this two-party system.
Why do you think so?
I'm getting that. You saw it clearly in relation to the St. George North by-election. It is not based on ideology. It's not based on philosophy. I don't think it is based on party preference of the reporters. But you may have certain media ownership interests, or you may have certain management interests inside of the media that is sympathetic to one party or another. And therefore, that bias comes over in the coverage. The St. George by-election, from the day it was announced, was cast as a two-party fight. Now, that may be the reality when the dust settles. But the truth of the matter, if the media is going to play a more responsible role in the preservation of further some maturing of our democracy, then it has to take a position which understands, hey, there are other parties in this fight, and we cannot present the picture of this being simply a two-party fight. That's the American way of doing it. That ought not to be the Barbadian way of doing it. I think also the issue of campaign financing, election financing, political party financing is critical. Listen, we need as a country to invest more in our democracy. We invest in all kinds of other things. We need to invest in our democracy. Democracy comes at a cost, but the price is worth it. See what is happening in the United States now when it was under threat seemingly a few days ago. It comes at a cost, but the price is worth it. And this country must be able to invest in its democracy. Our development is best pursued in a context where there is fuller expression of democracy in Barbados. That is what the PDP represents. That is what we stand for. That is what we're pushing.
Thank you, Bedford Attlee. Mr. Phillips?
Yes, thank you. Let's call them third parties then. All third parties are emergent parties. Actually, every party, especially the third parties, believe the assumption that was described by one of your callers, that there is a thirst for an alternative. There's a thirst among maybe the young or some disaffected voters that you want an alternative. That assumption was tested in St. George North. And I visited almost every house. Actually, I visited every house in St. George North. We dropped off flyers if people were not home. Discussed with persons our plan. It was generally accepted that our plan was the superior plan. I went to houses where people were desperately in poverty. And I said, I can hire them $100 a day for every unemployed person with no skills whatsoever, and $150 a day for everyone with skills.
So you were offering potential patronage then?
No, they were being hired. Because I was going to give up my consultancy practice and start a construction company and participate in the government's 1,000 houses initiative. If the government decided that they're not going to do that, we will build houses for anyone.
So where do we go from here?
Yes, that's what I'm trying to get at. I had thousands of people saying, yes, we support you. We support that package. And the people decided, rather than voting for that, to vote for fish. That was the Barbados Labour Party's economic plan to bring these people of St. George North out of poverty. Fish. Can you believe
it? What do you mean by fish?
They plan to go to the sea and catch fish and then bring them to St. George North and put them in barrels and let them grow. That was their plan. That was their stated plan. right? And not and what is so disappointing?
Or I think without, let me finish, please. I have to control the level. And
I know, but I barely got any time with this.
What wasn't that say in the context of a broader activity of aquaponics
or fish farming? That's correct.
Fish farming, to say it was about to bring fish is to disparage the
fish farming. Yes, fish farming. It was fish farming. Thank you. No,
right.
That was a lunatic solution to bring prosperity to the people of St. George North. And not a single media outlet has to date asked, where is the fish? Where is all this fish that you're talking about? It's almost 100 days now. No one cares about that. So we had if I was running, let's assume, because again, our plan was to make St. George North the most prosperous constituency in Barbados. And if I was running, let's say, against Michael Bloomberg in St. George North, and he was offering to give the people of St. George North, every family, $1 million, I would say, I would bow out and say, look, I endorse Michael Bloomberg because that is the best plan for you people of St. George North for the next 30 months.
And then I'll come back.
It is realizing that there's COVID, there's all sorts of problems, and therefore there's
a big fashion, sophisticated handout.
All right, great. But what I'm getting down at is that that's in the best interest of the people of St. George North that every family gets $1 million. You can't deny that. You can't.
Where is the development in that? It was
to tie them over until the COVID thing is over. Like ours. Ours was $100 a day. And they're working while they work on their businesses where they were going to export their products to countries where we had double taxation agreements that were favorable to Barbados. This was a good plan, and it was acknowledged as the best plan. Unfortunately, the media never looked at the plans.
Thank you, Gavin.
I know, but the economists never looked at them. No one looked at them. They just let people say lunatic stuff like bring a fish.
Can I have the input from Akana?